From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is our own Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for Family Research Council.
Welcome to the Thursday edition of Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here at Family Research Council. I am filling in for Tony Perkins. Well, you've heard a lot about this new platform from the New York Times, the 1619 Project. And Eric Erickson over at The Resurgent wrote a fascinating piece entitled "The Atoning Sacrifice of the Union Soldiers Means Nothing to the New York Times 1619 Project." And in just a minute, I'll talk with Bishop E.W. Jackson of Stand Against Communism. In my second segment, the FDA is out with new data that confirms the dangerous abortion pill Mifeprex has killed 24 women since the product was approved in September 2000. And I'll talk with our Petrina Mosley, FRC's Director of Life, Culture, and Women's Advocacy. At the bottom of the hour, an Arkansas church demonstrated the love of Christ by paying off $3 million in medical debt for people in its community. I'll talk with Pastor Chris Abington of City Church in Arkansas. And at 42 past the hour, some good news coming your way. A member of the Chinese Early Rain Covenant Church was just released from prison after 8 months behind bars. Gina Goh, the Southeast Asia Regional Manager for International Christian Concern, joins me with the story. As a reminder, our podcast is available at tonyperkins.com. Go there for resources, links, and guest bios. Follow Tony on Twitter if you'd like, at T. Perkins, or me, at Sarah P. Perry. Well, you've heard much about it. The New York Times has introduced a program called the 1619 Project, and it is, at bottom, a reframing of the entire foundation of American history. Eric Erickson over at The Resurgent wrote a piece that just came out, "The Atoning Sacrifice of the Union Soldiers Means Nothing to the New York Times 1619 Project." In his opening paragraph, he notes this, because at bottom, this is more than just revisionist history. It's more than just pushing a progressive agenda, as some have said. It really does deal with a spiritual question. Erickson writes this, "The United States very literally paid an atoning sacrifice for the sin of slavery. Union preachers of the day and the President of the United States came to see the war in that light. Prior to the Civil War, more and more prominent Americans began discussing it in that light. The war was divine wrath poured out on the nation for enslaving an entire population. While the New York Times may get there, its revisionist reframing exercise right now totally misses all of that." Joining me now with his analysis is Bishop E.W. Jackson of Stand Against Communism. Bishop Jackson, so glad to have you on Washington Watch.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so let's go first to the historical aspect of this platform and what some ideas of yours might be on what the New York Times, America's newspaper of record, as it's been called, is really trying to accomplish. What is, in your estimation, the biggest problem with the 1619 Project?
Well, it's the same problem that we have with much of the left, particularly their narrative with regard to racial and ethnic relationships in our country, and it's this. I think they want to use it as a way of delegitimizing the country itself. I think they want to fundamentally change America, and the only way you can do that is to make the case that America is really not a legitimate country. It's not a legitimate country because it was founded on slavery. It's not a legitimate country because it stole land from the Native Americans. It's not a legitimate country because of a whole host of injustices that they would name. What they don't tell us is, that they don't tell their acolytes is, that America was birthed at a time of brutal, dictatorial, totalitarian rule over the entire globe in most places in the world, and the only places where that might not have been true is tribal places, aboriginal places, and the continent of the United States is one of them. But for most of the world, people lived in subjugation, and only one country was born that offered a way out of that. And let me just add this quickly. This is the only nation that I'm aware of in my study of history that from the very beginning, voices were loud and clear against slavery. It was true that Nathaniel Bacon led an uprising in the 1600s, and he partnered with other, because we know the first Africans were brought as indentured servants, and intergenerational slavery was later added to the mix in order to maintain the control that they wanted to exercise over this labor force that they had. So they don't want to tell the whole story, because the whole story shows America's nobility at a time of tremendous brutality and barbarism. They want to tell the story of America as the barbarian, America as the illegitimate nation. And I think by doing so, they think, well, now we can remake America in the image of maybe Karl Marx or maybe, you know, some other type of ideology.
Oh, Bishop, I so totally agree with you. And I will tell you, I do think that the timing on this particular project is very interesting and probably not strictly circumstantial. Here we are, America's newspaper of record, which obviously leans progressive. It leans Democratic in its nature, in its coverage, in its descriptions. And this, I believe, is politically driven. This is sort of 2020 posturing, dressed in sort of the cloak of historical exposés, right? But to call the entire foundation of the country, as Nicole Hannah-Jones wrote in sort of the opening essay, democracy's founding ideals were false when they were written, is essentially that Marxist approach to, okay, it's all wrong. We have to uproot it. We have to tear it all apart. And we have to essentially recraft the entire country, which I think proves entirely problematic. We came to the country, this nation was founded in an attempt to eliminate an authoritarian regime. So I have a real problem with this recasting of history.
It's evil at its core. And there's no question that the timing is not coincidental, because after all, they thought that they were on the long march to convert America from a constitutional republic into some sort of socialist democracy, as they would put it. I would call it a totalitarian regime. Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump interfered with all of that. And he is persona non grata. In fact, that's understating the case. I mean, I think they hate him with an absolutely psychotic passion. And yes. This is one of the reasons why they're raising this, because the narrative has got to be no person of color, no, as they would put it, no American of African descent or American of Hispanic descent or Latino should ever vote for Donald Trump. No woman should ever vote for Donald Trump. Donald Trump is a racist. He's this, that, and the other. But actually, we're finding that more and more Latinos, more and more black citizens are realizing Donald Trump has done more for them than all the racial demagogues we've been hearing over the last 60 years who've done nothing but posture about the other guy being racist and the conservatives being racist and the Republicans being racist while doing nothing but holding black people captive in poverty and violence and ghettos without any hope of escape.
Oh, my gosh. We could do an entire show just on that notion about how the entire Democratic movement has been ultimately a disenfranchisement of the African-American community. And in so doing, to make sure that they have that voting segment moving forward. But I want to switch gears. I want to talk a little bit about the spiritual aspect of the Civil War, because we understand that Abraham Lincoln was a man of God. He petitioned the Lord frequently for wisdom in what must have been a time for deep personal struggle. We know 750,000 Americans lost their lives, the biggest battle ever recorded to take human lives. So Erickson writes that the cost of human life was really reparation for the sin of slavery, and that, to argue Democrats' additional argument for reparations, is really sort of missing the point, isn't it?
When the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments were passed, as far as I am concerned, and as I believe for every black American, that should be the reparations for this reason. There is no person whose ancestry remained in Africa, no person there who can say, wow, we are so much better off that our ancestors weren't taken to America. Look, I am the great-grandson of slaves. Gabriel and Eliza Jackson were slaves and then sharecroppers in Orange County, Virginia. Mm. I honor them, and I have to consider that what they went through was a blessing to me, because while they did not experience the freedom I do, I am their heir, and I am an American, and I get to experience what people around the world envy, and the ability to fulfill my God-given calling and potential and abilities in a place that is better for doing that than any place else on the face of the earth. There's the reparations right there that their the heirs of slaves got to experience the greatest and most prosperous and most free nation that mankind has ever witnessed, and we are the beneficiaries of that. So, yeah, look, this is the other thing. This whole thing of white supremacy and white people and white privilege, the fact of the matter is slavery wouldn't have ended without a lot of very courageous and decent, honorable, loving, quote-unquote, white people putting their lives on the line because they believed that slavery was wrong, not only in the Civil War, but leading up to it, and even in the aftermath when they were during segregation. A third of the people lynched were white because they were standing up for our rights. And so to try to paint this nation as a racist nation means you got to forget all the people who have sacrificed to help make sure that America was free and just for all of our people.
You know what I also love is the fact that in this article, this unique take on the fact that there is a spiritual component here that I think the New York Times is missing, as Eric Erickson writes, there is an understanding that the God of the Old Testament is the same as the God of the New Testament, and God does not take lightly to sin. There is an element of his holy wrath that has to be accepted, and for the people who professed a saving knowledge of that same God, they recognized this blood shed on American soil really represents God's wrath fully executed. And yes, God is love, but God also will not be mocked. And he did not take lightly to indenturing to the servitude, the slavery of an entire race of people. And in the minute we have left, do you think there is an element there that we have a tendency as Christians to forget, that we focus on the love is love, and that's great. God is love, but God also will not be mocked.
Well, the Word of God says that without the shedding of blood, there is no remission of sin. Now, we know that refers primarily to Jesus' blood, but I think it says something else, too, which is that be not deceived. Galatians 6 says, God is not mocked. Whatever man sows, that shall he also reap. And when you sow evil, you're going to reap it. And that's one of the reasons why I fight so hard to make sure America is a godly nation, because therein lies the key to our peace, our prosperity, and our future for our posterity.
Bishop E.W. Jackson, an excellent guest from Stand Against Communism. You are listening to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships, filling in for Tony Perkins. Coming up next, the FDA has confirmed that the dangerous abortion pill Mifeprax has killed 24 women since the product was approved in September 2000. I'll talk with Petrina Mosley, FRC's Director of Life, Culture, and Women's Advocacy, next.
In states like New York, Virginia, and Vermont, radical legislation has been written legalizing abortion late in pregnancy, when babies can feel pain and are able to live outside the womb.
Happy birthday to you.
They've gone even further, repealing protections of infants born alive, allowing killing even after birth.
Happy
Congress has yet to protect the life of every newborn baby. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com to send Nancy Pelosi a newborn hat to show Congress every new life should be welcomed with warmth and love, not hate, not death. End birthday abortions. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com.
Happy birthday to you.
Paid for by Family Research Council.
Are you concerned with the state of our nation? Do you want to protect and promote religious freedom, the sanctity of life, free speech, and our children's educations? Today we see a growing threat against our values on the news, on our college campuses, in our elementary schools, at our public libraries, and in our courts. Every year in Washington, D.C., thousands of conservatives attend FRC Action's Values Voters Summit. From October 11th to the 13th, come to our nation's capital to mingle with and hear from key conservatives who are bringing real change to Washington, D.C., and learn how you can too. FRC President Tony Perkins will be there, along with Ali Stuckey, Bill Bennett, Dana Lash, Oliver North, and U.S. House and Senate leaders. The 2020 elections are right around the corner, so this is one weekend you won't want to miss. We provide free scholarships for students. Register online at valuesvotersummit.org or call 1-877-372-2808. That's 1-877-372-2808.
Are you looking for timely and honest coverage of the latest news? Do you find it difficult to sort out what is true and what is false from the media? Family Research Council is here to help. FRC President Tony Perkins' daily Washington Update email newsletter addresses the most important current events affecting religious freedom, the protection of life, marriage and family, and more, not only in Washington, but around the world. The Washington Update's daily articles cover a range of topics, from underreported stories about transgender activists' efforts to infiltrate our schools to updates on court cases fighting for religious freedom, parental rights, and the protection of life. Don't miss this critical, in-depth analysis of the day's most essential stories that are shaping our nation's future. Learn more and subscribe by visiting frc.org/update. Again, that's frc.org/update.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry. I'm sitting in for Tony Perkins. TonyPerkins.com is our website. You'll find plenty there. More resources to illuminate today's discussion. Well, if you've heard about the abortion pill, Mifeprex, you also know, if you're doing your homework, that the pill itself has been approved by the FDA, but has also updated their adverse effects lists, and it has included two additional deaths in the past 8 months. Joining me now with her analysis is Petrina Mosley, Family Research Council's Director of Life, Culture, and Women's Advocacy. Petrina, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Happy to be back. Thanks for having me, Sarah.
Well, we've talked about the dangers of chemical abortion before, but I don't think that the average listener is aware of the fact that not only does this drug have FDA approval, and to put that in context, you can't use most essential oils because they aren't FDA approved, or you can use them, but, you know, assumption of the risk. Mm-hmm. This pill has killed 24 women since the product was approved in September 2000. So first I want to ask you, how does the abortion pill work and why is it potentially deadly for women who take it?
Okay, so a chemical abortion is also referred to as the abortion pill, and it is a two-pill regimen where one pill, mifepristone, it affects the woman's ability to carry the embryo to term. So it affects the lining of the uterus so that the baby can't implant. And then the second pill, misoprostol, is taken after a certain amount of time to induce contractions so that the woman is basically dispelling the child out of her uterus. It is a very gruesome process. I don't understand why this would be advertised as the go-to product for women by the abortion industry. It is traumatic on a woman's body physically, obviously, with 24 women having to have died already, the numerous adverse effects such as infections, ectopic pregnancies, blood transfusions, hospitalizations. The list goes on and on. I mean, Sarah, right now we're at nearly 4,200 adverse effects just from Mifeprex, the abortion pill. And these are only effects that have been reported to FDA. You know, most time people don't report.
Right.
So just imagine how many more numerous cases are out there that are going unreported. Yet Planned Parenthood and the abortion industry markets this pill as safe and effective and good for women. It boggles my mind.
So I was talking yesterday, when I was talking to Cindy Collins, and we were talking about her recovery from abortion. We were talking about sort of some gestational ages. And I mentioned what I had experienced at 10 weeks, which was a miscarriage. But I've read that you can take this pill up until the 10th week of pregnancy. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my gosh.
It hasn't always been that way. Before, when it was first approved, you could only take it at 7 weeks. But under the Obama administration, they moved the gestation week to 10 weeks, which makes it even more unsafe and more riskier. I mean, Sarah, at 10 weeks, a child has fingers, toes,
A heartbeat.
They have a thumb, a heartbeat. Oh, let alone, obviously a heartbeat. So it is unbelievable. This makes it even more just horrific to the child, of course, but even more horrific to a woman's body. And, you know, what makes a chemical abortion unique, Sarah, is that a woman has to see what happens to the fetal remains of her child. Okay, this is not a pretty picture that Planned Parenthood describes. You go to Planned Parenthood's website, and they will tell you that it is a safe and effective option for a woman to do at home. She can be by herself, and this can be a private situation, and she just needs to sit on the toilet, and then the whole thing will be over, and her contents will be empty. No. I think a great go-to reality check on the violence of the chemical abortion pill is seeing the Unplanned movie. If you have not seen it, I encourage the hearers to see it. And in that movie, you will see Abby Johnson's chemical abortion experience. Now, I think probably that's what earned its R rating, is that it shows the violence of abortion.
Wow.
But it truly depicts what happens in a chemical abortion. It is not pretty, it is not safe, and it is not simple.
Now, this is precisely the drug that the California State Senate Health Committee has sort of passed on a bill out of committee back in April. And this bill would actually make requiring this pill at campuses and universities in California required. So not just as an option, not a referral out off of campus, but actually would require university health departments to carry this pill for their students. That's unconscionable to me.
It is. And I mean, can you imagine, one, having an abortion is a traumatic experience anyway. The psychological effects cannot be denied, as your listeners have already heard on your previous episode. But just imagine having to see the effects of an abortion, to see the fetal remains, and to have that happen in a young woman's dorm room on a college campus. This is highly traumatic, and this bill in particular, SB 24, comes with no pre-counseling, so the woman doesn't even have to say why she's getting an abortion. The physician doesn't even have to inquire about maybe she's being coerced or pressured, which many women are, to see maybe if there's other options for her. This is just another way for the abortion business to make more money, Sarah. It's a business because we already know Planned Parenthood facilities are already in decline, which is why they're building mega centers to push out the smaller competition.
Sure.
But now they can also push their products on college student health center campuses. It's a business model. This isn't care for women.
So we've got about a minute left here. In light of everything, these 4,200 adverse effects, what do we do to get the abortion pill banned in the United States?
Number one, we have to make women know about the adverse effects of this pill so they can make an informed decision for themselves, as well as informing them about the abortion pill reversal. Like I said, this is a two-step process. There is a reversal in place that a woman can take and learn more about at abortionpillreversal.com. And then secondly, we've got to put good leaders of integrity in the FDA, and hopefully that will happen under this administration.
Patrina Mosley, our Director of Life Culture and Women's Advocacy. You are listening to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Thursday edition. Well, you will want to hear this good news story. An Arkansas church paid off $3 million in medical debt for people in its community. They decided to go out and be like Jesus. I'll talk with Pastor Chris Abingdon of City Church coming up next on Washington Watch.
Did you know that Planned Parenthood was using taxpayer dollars to perform abortions? Recently, the Trump administration made changes to a healthcare policy called Title 10. The changes to this policy now eliminate the loopholes organizations like Planned Parenthood were using to receive taxpayer funding for abortions. Planned Parenthood was hiding behind terms like reproductive health care and services like cancer screenings and contraception distribution, while in reality, they were making money off of abortions. This shift in funding will benefit community health centers that provide needy families with family planning resources and health services, regardless of their ability to pay. It will also benefit pregnancy resource centers that provide care and free resources to women who may be experiencing an unplanned pregnancy. This policy decision is the right move to help and protect American lives. To learn more, visit frc.org/Title 10. That's frc.org/Title 10.
Hi, my name is Bailey. I am serving as an intern at Family Research Council, and it has been a life-changing experience. Interns join FRC's team of experts as they embark upon the mission of advancing faith, family, and freedom in public policy and the culture from a biblical worldview. The FRC internship is a 12 to 15 week program designed to educate and inspire university students who are passionate about public service and who believe that a biblical worldview is fundamental to the reformation of government and culture. As interns, we receive the opportunity to work alongside and be personally and professionally developed by FRC's team of experts. This paid internship offers free housing in the heart of DC, which allows us to be fully immersed in the fast-paced political climate and to build a community with other faithful conservatives in our nation's capital. For more information and to apply, visit frc.org/internships. That's frc.org/internships.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. Well, I tell you what, thousands of people in River Valley, Arkansas, fairly small community, have a new sense of freedom. Incredibly, City Church in Russellville just paid off more than $3 million of medical debt for its neighbors. Joining me now to talk about how all of this came together is Pastor Chris Abingdon of City Church. Pastor Abingdon, so glad to have you here.
Hey, good afternoon.
I got to tell you, my husband was so excited because he shared this news story on his Facebook page not 2 days ago. And so he said, really? Oh, tell him for me how excited I am about what he did. We're in a situation where the world is replete with bad news. It's full of problems. It's full of divisions. And quite frankly, the church very frequently gets a bad rap. So let me tell you, I am so grateful, as are we in Washington Watch, for your demonstration of Christ's unconditional love. Thank you for what you've done.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
So tell us the backstory, if you would. How did you begin to consider the idea of raising money to help pay off this particular type of debt?
Sure. Yeah. And so just to be clear, and I'll walk you through the process, you know, it did eliminate a little over $3 million in bad medical debt. Our investment wasn't that. We utilized a group called RIP Medical Debt, R-I-P Medical Debt. And the story kind of started, we heard a church in Kansas back in Easter had done it for their city. And so our campus pastor emailed me the link, and we just said, could this really happen? Is this possible to do something like this? So we contacted them, found out the validity of it, called the RIP Medical Debt guys in New York. They, you know, they're an amazing organization that just started, you know, trying to help veterans essentially pay off bad medical debt. And so we just started investigating, and the first step of that was to find out, okay, in our county, there has to be so much bad medical debt, essentially, before you can apply for them to purchase this debt. So we found that in Pope County, there was over $2.6 million in bad medical debt. And when I say bad medical debt, there's some qualifiers for them that they're looking for. So you have to be at a minimum. You can't make more, let me say it like this, you can't make more than 2 times the federal poverty level. So to qualify for this, you can't make more than that. You have to be insolvent, so, you know, the debt's got to be greater than a person's assets, and then there are individuals with a financial hardship, so, you know, measuring their income. So to qualify, they they have a system to qualify people, so we don't know. It's privacy because it's medical. We have no idea who these sure. people are. But we know there's a segment of the population of our community that there's over 2.6 million. So, you know, for us, we found out they could purchase for $26,000, they could purchase 2.6 million in our county. And that impacts about 1,400 households, just a little under that.
Wow.
And so once we determined this was real, we said, well, this matches our heart. Our church is for the city. And like you just said, there's enough bad news. You know, for us, our heart isn't that we don't think a church inside of only walls. Like, there's just a simple reality loving people that they need a demonstration of it sometimes. As much as they need to hear it, they need to see it. So we just real quick said, let's do it. Like, let's go for that.
About 20% of Americans have unpaid medical debt, and the American Journal of Medicine actually reported that medical debt contributes to more than 60% of bankruptcies. So based on these pre-qualifiers, based on what you know about the community and what it took, essentially, very little in relation to a great, great deal, these were individuals yeah. for whom, for example, a $1,500 contribution literally changes their lives because sure. of where they are in the income level. So for sure. someone who loves people like Jesus, who acts like Jesus, who puts skin in the game, doesn't just talk the talk, compare this medical debt situation with the debt that we have to God, because I got to tell you, I know you've mm-hmm. thought about it.
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's a demonstration because, I mean, that story is our story. There's no way I'm going to pay my way out of my life. There's just no way. And so somebody else stepped in, being Jesus, stepped in and paid, absolutely paid the entire debt. And so, again, scriptures say that God demonstrated his love for us by sending his son. So there was always a demonstration out of his love that came to people, me included. So if we can demonstrate and follow that way of Jesus, you bet we're going to be in for that.
I really love what you said in one of the interviews that I read, because the story really has gone viral, Pastor. It's been really fascinating to see how hungry people are for this kind of good news and to see that the body of Christ goes out and does yeah. what we are commanded mm-hmm. to do. But you quoted Psalm 34:8 in your interview yeah. with one yeah. of the papers. Yeah. And what does that scripture say that really impressed upon you?
Yeah, so, you know, scripture, at one time I saw this as a pattern as much as I did, you know, knowing how good God was. But it says, taste and see that the Lord is good. And I just discovered at some point, people really don't, they want to believe he's that good, but they don't know if he is. And sometimes they need a taste of his goodness, and it causes their eyes to open and to see God for who he is. He is good.
Oh, I love this story. Pastor Chris Abingdon of City Church in Arkansas, thank you for acting,
You're
for
welcome.
Being, for talking like Jesus. You are listening to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry. I am sitting in for Tony Perkins. Good news out of China, and we get it so rarely in the struggle for human rights and religious liberty, but a church elder has been released from prison after 8 months behind bars. After a lengthy struggle, Gina Goh, the Southeast Asia Regional Manager for International Christian Concerns, joins me with the situation in China, coming up next.
We live in a time of great political division, and this division only intensifies during campaign season. The toxic tone in politics can be discouraging, which makes it a very real temptation for many Christians to wipe their hands of politics altogether. After all, if God is sovereign and controls the heart of the king, as Proverbs says, do we really need to get involved in the messy world of politics? Because political engagement can be divisive, shouldn't Christians abandon politics and direct their energies toward more spiritual pursuits? Christians are called to submit every area of their life to God, which includes how they engage in politics. But they are called to engage biblically. This requires Christians to be prepared to follow their political theology to its logical end and vote for candidates and parties that support clear biblical values. For more information on the Christians' call to engage in politics, visit frc.org/engage. That's frc.org /engage.
Radical abortion laws in New York, Illinois, and Vermont are challenging the sanctity of life. These laws have lifted the few existing restrictions on abortion in the name of family planning and mental health of pregnant mothers. Americans need to take a stand and defend the rights of the unborn. Family Research Council is sending Congress 90,000 baby hats as a reminder that babies should be welcomed with love and warmth, not potential danger. Supporters have already funded over 45,000 hats. We are over halfway there. Join Americans across the nation and donate $9 to send a powerful reminder that young lives need to be cherished. When you take action, we'll send you an end birthday abortion certificate that will remind you to pray for born alive babies who are facing the danger of being killed outside the womb. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com for more information. That's endbirthdayabortion.com.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins, President of the Family Research Council here in Washington, D.C., and I would like to invite you to join my wife, LaWanna, and I, along with Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin and former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, for FRC's Israel Tour, June the 2nd through the 12th, 2020. Whether you're sailing on the Sea of Galilee, standing in the ruins of Capernaum, or journeying up to Jerusalem, Israel is unlike any other place on earth. You'll relive the final earthly days of Jesus as you pray in the Garden of Gethsemane. You look upon Golgotha and stand in the Garden Tomb. The reality of his story will come alive in a transformative way. This one-of-a-kind tour will not only allow you to explore the land of the Bible and the roots of our Christian faith, you'll also hear firsthand from some of Israel's political, defense, and religious leaders. Join us June the 2nd through June the 12th for this life-changing experience. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. TonyPerkins.com is our podcast website. You can find information about our guests, resources, publications, and action steps there. We encourage you to listen and share on your social media platforms. Follow Tony on Twitter at T. Perkins, or me, if you'd care to, at Sarah P. Perry. Well, as you know, we at Family Research Council have been closely monitoring the oppression against Christians and other religious minorities in China in the struggle for universal human rights, among those the ability to exercise faith freely. And finally, we are coming up with some unexpected good news. After a crackdown in a house church in China, Elder Li Yingyang, a member of the Early Rain Covenant Church in China, has been released after serving 8 months in prison. Now, on December 11th, 2018, he was among over 160 Early Rain Church members arrested during communist government raids on the unrecognized house church. According to a Facebook group that provides updates about the church, he was sent back to his hometown where he was reunited with his wife and children. And I am sure they were certain and glad to see him. In fact, you can go to the Facebook page to be kept up to speed with any developments in the case of Elder Li Yingyang and the pastor, as well as the other 160 others who were arrested. Go to facebook.com/prayforearlyrain. That's facebook.com, pray for, F-O-R, early rain. Joining me to fill us in on the backstory and celebrate the good news is Gina Goh, Southeast Asia Regional Manager of International Christian Concern. Gina, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hi, Sarah. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm so glad that you're here to give us some good news. You must be delighted that Li, who is a member of this covenant church, was just released on Sunday after 8 months in prison. Were you surprised that he was actually let out on bail?
Actually, I'm not that surprised because there were news that he was going to be released, but we just don't know when. Several other elders or Christians that were detained earlier, like some of the deacons, their families have received, insider info from the police that, they should be out soon, but they never were given a date. So one by one, they were released until Right now, there are only three remaining. So Elder Lin Chang's family, even I believe about 2 weeks ago, his wife was still writing kind of like a blog post, sharing how, you know, it has been very challenging for her. Sometimes she just misses him so much. And so I'm sure it comes as a surprise in that way that suddenly this news just dropped, because she was still trying to find out which detention center he's at and trying to send clothes for him, because she was never able to meet with him during this 8-month period.
To be arrested during worship services, I have to tell you, I have such a newfound appreciation and a sense of sort of humility from the standpoint that we take so for granted here in the United States, in the West, our ability to worship freely. We just assume that it will always be that way. And yet we understand that religious persecution is an ongoing crisis in multiple other nations, not the least of which is China. And I have to quote from an interview that Lee gave to the South China Morning Post when the church's worship gatherings were discussed. He said that they will continue to go on no matter how many people are arrested. And here was his exact quote. He said, quote, "Even if we are down to our last five, worship and gatherings will still go on because our faith is real. Persecution is a price worth paying for the Lord. We would rather live through it than to hide our faith and hope more Chinese churches will speak up and stand with us." I am almost embarrassed for the ease I have of getting up and going to church on Sunday morning. I have never in my life experienced this level of persecution. And yet, here he is saying, we're going to keep going. So he's just released on bail. He's now home, reunited with his family, which must have been an incredible comfort to him. And he's still saying, if it happens again, we're still going to do it. I mean, that kind of commitment is unspeakably inspirational. It is tremendous.
Yes. And actually, I also have another story from his very young son and daughter, because a while ago, one time, his wife, Zhang Xinyue, was asking her kids, you know, would you prefer that dad stay in the prison for the faith or come out for the sake of us? And the kids, one is 8 years old and one is like toddler age, they said, no, we want him to stay for the Lord.
Oh,
you know,
wow.
For kids to say something like that, you can imagine how, you know, much it is, how strong it is put me like out of words, really, because, you know, for kids this age, you know, it's the time that they enjoy spending time with their father. And I know they miss their father terribly, but at the same time, they understand that the father is, you know, being in jail for the Lord, and they would rather that he suffer for the Lord than be reunited with them. So I think it's very inspiring. Reading this type of blog post from his wife has encouraged me greatly as well. And sometimes I read it and I was just in tears, because I'm like, wow, this faith is something that I really admire. And I think we also lack of, because we are so comfortable in Western world. So
absolutely.
Yeah, I'm really inspired by him. And I mean, this is not something easy to say, you know, but yeah, I also know that he endured once in prison. He was going through this torture called putting through needle. So what they do is they chained your feet to the ground so your feet could not move. And then they put both of your arms under one of your legs. So it's if your arms were through your legs, as like, you know, thread going through needle, and then they tie you with a chain or something like that for a few days, because his fellow prisoner fast and pray.
I have to tell you, this kind of crackdown. And this is really what it was, because they came through in a sweep. And Lee recognized that this kind of a crackdown for their church was unprecedented and a sign that the communist authorities wanted to close down the church for good. So what was the reason that the Chinese authorities gave for the arrest of the church members?
Everybody kind of was placed under different charges. For Elder Li Yingchang, his charge was, you know, stirring up trouble and trying to pick quarrel. And for Pastor Wang Yi, his quote-unquote crime was subversion of state power and also quote-unquote illegal business. And they were, I remember at least one that was put under illegal publication. So it's all different trumped-up charges, but most of them were under, you know, subversion or something like stirring up troubles. But the interesting thing is they were criminally detained, yet they didn't really go through any, like, legal process, right? There was no trial. And a lot of times, like, these family members had no idea where their loved ones were being held. So the legal system, justice system, is almost non-existent when it comes to this type of persecution, because they really just want to scare you and just, you know, try to stop your activities. And the reason why he is back to his hometown is not because they're like, hey, you know, like, welcome back to your hometown. It's because they wanted to spread them out. So several of the leaders of churches, once they were released, they could not go back to Chengdu where they used to live. They basically were all forced to go back to their hometown. And a lot of them are from, you know, countryside, but they just want to force them to go back and try to break them apart. So they think that, oh, by not gathering them, this church will fall apart by itself.
Oh, wow. This is really a systemic problem, an endemic problem in China. This is part of an overall crackdown on worship that's not sanctioned by China. This is part of their stricter regulations on religious affairs that were passed in early 2018. And I would imagine people like the congregants here at Early Rain Covenant Church who are open about their faith probably draw the attention of the Chinese authorities. And it is so much more justifiable, so much easier to target them and to pick them out. And in fact, Pastor Wang is, as you said, he is detained on charges of inciting subversion to state power. But what can you tell the listeners about his remarkable story? Because he's really as incredible an individual as Li is.
Oh, yes. So he actually has a legal background. So he's a lawyer himself, but he came to the Lord and it really, you know, changed his life. So he's like basically very passionate for the faith. And so he decided to study, you know, at theological school and went on to lead this church. And his church is kind of under the reform type of Presbyterian type of model. And he's not afraid to speak out for the persecuted. And also, he's not afraid to criticize Chinese government. And in a context like China, you understand how risky that is. However, he's not afraid to speak up, and he knew very well that one day he's going to, quote-unquote, invite trouble, but it's not going to deter him. And he also educates his congregation to do the same, because you have to stand up for the right thing. And, of course, some people also criticize him for being like, oh, it's stupid, you know, for the survival of church, you should stay low. Why are you being so outspoken? But he believes what is right is right. What is wrong is wrong. We cannot just let the government do whatever they want. And if you claim to be respecting the rule of law as a government, then you should follow this proper procedure instead of just like, you know, rule by people, right? And just use whatever law you want to persecute people. So, you know, he's good friends with a lot of the activists, you know, people who fight for religious freedoms or fellow Christians who have suffered. So people have a lot of respect for him.
Oh, I have to tell you, these leaders in these churches and everyday congregants, individuals like you and me who go through what they do simply for the freedom of being able to worship and are willing to assume the cost, absolutely amazed me. It really, really amazes me. In early 2018, as we talked about, the regime passed new regulations that banned what are considered unauthorized theological, unauthorized religious teachings. In the 2019 annual U.S. Commission report on international religious freedom states that the Chinese government is persecuting all faiths in an effort to break off unacceptable faiths. It's a campaign that is trying to diminish and erase the independent practice of religion, but also cultural and linguistic heritages of other minorities, for example, the Tibetan Buddhists or the Uyghur Muslims. And Open Doors ranks China as the 27th worst country in the world when it comes to Christian persecution. So this, to me, seems to be part and parcel of President Xi Jinping's ruling in this country. This is something that he has sort of swept up. He has increased the level of crackdown, the level of hostility toward religions that are in the minority in China. But here we are listening as American Christians. We are listening to this story. If you could tell our listeners, as someone who represents International Christian Concern, who understands this story intimately, what to do about a situation that to us feels very far away in China, what would be your suggestion?
Sure. I think one thing not to overlook is the power of prayer. I think a lot of the persecuted Christians we work with, when we tell them that, you know, you are not forgotten, people are praying for you, don't think you're alone. I think that's one of the greatest encouragement they can have, because, of course, like, especially in China, you know, you cannot send them money or letters, or, you know, right, they get blocked or they get traced, but at least, like, prayer is the least and also the most you can do for them. And, you know, continue to track, or, you know, like you said, the Facebook pages, you know, they are people who try their best to bring out the news from inside the Great Wall, because we also know they have firewall and, you know, they have to jump through all the loops to try to bring the news out and, you know, try to avoid the security monitoring and all that thing. So I think to show that we care, one thing is to pray, and then also, you know, if you are able to talk to your representative and say, you know, we should put more pressure on the Chinese government to respect religious freedom, we, of course, don't know how effective that's going to be, but it doesn't hurt to continue to put pressure, because the Chinese government, they want their, you know, in Chinese, there's a saying that, you know, they don't want to throw face, you know, so they want to conserve their face in a way. So you want to make sure you continue to bring this issue up to them, you know, time and time and again, and say, you know, we care about the religious freedom of Chinese people. So, you know, you should not feel like you can do whatever you want to all this, you know, believers or, you know, practitioners of different faiths, because we are watching you.
Gina Goh, who is regional manager for Southeast Asia at International Christian Concern, has been my guest. For more information about ICC, go to persecution.org. This has been Washington Watch. I've been Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. We will be back tomorrow on Washington Watch together. And in the meantime, as Gina said, don't underestimate the power of prayer. We'll see you next time.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.